swings the panel in a very different direction, and in a very into a direction of deep particularity. So we'll have to implode it at the end. I think this conference exemplifies many of the characteristics of what we think happens in scholar networks, as well as much of what actually happens. I think all of us have a sense that scholar networks are somehow free of the world. They float above or beyond it. They exist in a privileged space and time where the participants are gathered together from all over the world without too much difficulty. I didn't hear any horror stories of plane flights, or not too many. And where the communication is on the whole easy, free-floating, and of course brilliant. But I'm also struck by the fact that we're sitting in this room built less than 6 years ago, a room which is really frustratingly inadequate for the purposes it now must contain. This was more obvious yesterday when there was this pile-up of equipment of overhead projectors, two slide projectors, two data projectors, three lots of cable running here. It was an accident waiting to happen. I don't think we're a special group in the humanities in our need for this kind of equipment, but when the room was designed nearly a decade ago, I don't think anyone would have foreseen that the humanities would become so involved with digital technologies, or at least not to this degree. Were we able to redo this room now, I think it would look rather different. The point I want to make here, which I'll elaborate using the historical example of the University of London, is that scholarly communication, like all other communication, is embedded physically in the material world and is both shaped and anchored by it. We've been discussing the interface between the human and the machine, but we have to enlarge it, as a number of people have suggested, enlarge our sense of either the interface or the machine, realize that the material systems were actually interacting with a much larger, multiple and more complex, and several of you have suggested that. And I think at that point the question arises, is interface or any notion of a kind of discrete us interacting with a discrete it really appropriate? And it seems to me that interface as a word sort of loses a lot of value. So I'm going to give my example now. Having said that, speaking specifically as an historian, I was very taken by the assertion this morning the insistence that we have to be careful of cultural baggage in our metaphors and in our words. And so I want to assert that we have to be careful of the historical baggage of scholar networks. Now, I started out in my abstract by suggesting that the University of London was a virtual university. So let me explain. When the University of London was founded in 1836, it exhibited the one essential characteristic of a university. It awarded degrees. It did nothing else. It awarded degrees through examination. It had no campus, no classrooms, no libraries, no students. It existed as a small set of rooms in Somerset House, which was the purpose-built government office building that housed several other government departments and learned societies. It didn't stay there long, however, and it's worth tracing its traversals around London for the next century. In 1853, it moved to Marlborough House, which was a vacant royal palace, then to Burlington House, another government office building in 1856, when Marlborough House had to be cleared to hold the Prince of Wales establishment. In 1870, it achieved its first purpose-built headquarters on the same site as Burlington House, Burlington Gardens, a building which many of you will remember as the Museum of Mankind for about 20 years. Then finally in 1900, it moved entirely out of the center of London to the Imperial Institute in the South Kensington area. And finally, in 1927, it acquired the Bloomsbury site where it is now, and in 1936, with the help of an enormous grant from Rockefeller, moved in. In other words, the University of London, which one thought could have existed almost anywhere in London until it became a teaching university in 1900, existed in specific places, and these specific places changed. And the reasons for these changes within the terrain of London tell us a lot about the nature of networks and universities. First of all, virtually all human interaction quickly requires and acquires instruments. These accumulate and become collections. The University of London obviously, right at the beginning, had a couple of desks and chairs, but it almost immediately required examination desks. required specific equipment to go with those examinations, and that equipment very quickly became specimens, models, chemicals, equipment for conducting chemistry, physics tests, and other kinds of tests. When it got its first headquarters building in 1870, the very next year it acquired a library. So that once it had a space, it started specifically accumulating collections. Second, the University of London, despite the fact that its only function was to award degrees, immediately required very specific physical spaces to house its immaterial function. These spaces were in short supply in London, especially with the government's ability to dispense them, and were in very hot demand from other kinds of institutions. The University of London was in competition. It was in fact this competition for these spaces that led to the frequent movement of the university. The University of London needed, beyond offices and a couple of storerooms, it needed examination rooms that required at least one large empty space to accommodate hundreds of candidates. This same kind of space, however, was ideal for other kinds of activities. Museums wanted the space for exhibitions, learned societies wanted the space for meeting rooms, and through the course of the century, all of these other institutions fought with the government to get those spaces, and the university often lost. The university's position was determined by the availability of this specific kind of space. It was placed first in Somerset House because the Royal Academy had vacated its meeting rooms and exhibition galleries to go to purpose-built space at the new National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. The university's neighbor at Somerset House was the School of Design, and the two are probably put together because they're both educational bodies, sort of similar in the government's mind. All subsequent moves constitute a kind of oscillation between affiliation with learned societies, the Royal Academy and other bodies, or the School of Design for the next 100 years. Now, the third point, to begin to return to the issue of scholar networks, is it makes a difference where networks are anchored. For most of its history, the position of the university was determined by its proximity to museums or museum-like collections. The School of Design was the forerunner of the Victoria and Albert Museum, and for fully half of the university's first century, the location of the university was tied to the fortunes of the School of Design, which became first the Department of Practical Art under the Board of Trade, and then the Department of Science and Art under the Board of, under the Committee, a Privy Council Committee on Education. Out of the School of Design precipitated both many museums at South Kensington and also the Imperial College of Science. In the debates beginning in 1911 as to where the University of London might finally suitably reside now that it was a teaching university and then thus needed a campus, the primary choices were between a site near South Kensington or a site next to the British Museum. In other words, right through to the final point where the university finally stops its movement, the idea of the university was deeply embedded in the idea of the museum. The two are, in fact, inseparable. And indeed, part of the discussion of whether to go to the British Museum or to the site near Holland Park site was determined by the character of the British Museum. The British Museum was historical rather than scientific or industrial in its collections. The choice of the British Museum over the South Kensington Association was in part a validation of one vision of scholarship over another, that is, of scholarship as being primarily historical rather than that historical studies was more critical to the nature of the university than the sciences in the 1920s. But let me return explicitly to scholar networks. The most interesting story from mid-century in Britain in the development of disciplinary knowledge is the rise of the physical sciences as separate academic disciplines that are housed in the university. But this is not a development which was at all inevitable. There was a very real possibility throughout the middle of the century that the physical sciences would be housed in the museums of London, not the universities. As I've said, the South Kensington site housed both museums and the Department of Science and Art. both internally and in relationship to each other, this situation was much more complex than its current simplified condition suggests. There's only a small handful of museums on that site and a small handful of bodies of higher learning. So, for example, you might be surprised to know that the Victoria and Albert Museum, then called the South Kensington Museum, even as it had acquired one of the leading collections of sculpture, Old Master sculpture in Europe, also housed active fish hatcheries until 1880. In other words, it's a place where you would go to see fish spawn at the South Kensington Museum, and then you'd go upstairs and look at masterpieces of medieval sculpture. There were also physics and chemistry labs. There's a lot of talk about how dangerous some of the chemistry labs are. They're always worried that they're going to blow up and blow up the backside of the museum. Along with the art and the fish, the physics lab, the South Kensington housed a museum of practical foodstuffs. It housed museums of global business, museums of naval architecture, and museums of educational research. The scientific and scholarly networks of the mid-19th century were only marginally intersecting with universities, unlike, say, classics or philosophy or mathematics, which pretty much were contained within the university. Someone so prominent as Thomas Huxley, you know, easily the most prominent scientist of the second half of the century in Britain, had a career outside the university. He worked for the Department of Science and Art at South Kensington. So it's useful to think of South Kensington, and so though the university won, and the museum affiliation, which in the 19th century was considered absolutely essential to the notion of a university, now seems distinctly odd to us. This wasn't what the situation looked like on the ground in the third quarter, particularly of the 19th century. It's useful to think, I think, of the South Kensington site as containing the same kind of sprawl of centers and organized research units as the modern scientists have today. I don't know, since we're all in the humanities, I don't know if you've ever taken a very close look at your university catalogs, but should you do that, you would be quite surprised at the amount of FTE located in non-teaching units in the sciences. And they all have complicated titles. The humanities just within the last decade is going down the same route, and we now have all these complicated centers of this and centers of that, and you know, and multi-campus research groups and so on. I think we should be aware then that our own kind of sprawl of centers, there was this hint of this yesterday with discussion of what is new media consist of, where is it going, and so on, that as we happily develop all of these centers and engage in this kind of happy interdisciplinarity of research units and so on, we might ask where it's all headed, and I don't think we'll be able to predict. And I suspect, just as I'll give you a prediction because you'll never catch me in this, I suspect that from 100 years from now, our current notion that the university is embedded in the business idea will look just as odd as the university being embedded in the museum idea. And I think it's one of our jobs is to open up these other possibilities, not to accept any of our current situation as inevitable. Finally, I've been talking about things and containers and anchors, but I should also talk about maps and circuits. Another aspect of the university's placement was where it could be mapped in the city. Even as late as the 1920s, South Kensington was thought of as too far from central London, too suburban. The advantage of all the bus lines and tube stops were pointed out in the debate over Holland Park versus the Duke of Bedford site near the British Museum. But the British Museum, in the end, won in another reason, because it was closer, explicitly it was said, it's closer to railroad termini. Now, why would railroad termini be more important than tube stops or bus lines? It was also said to be close to the city, which is the financial centre of London, and Westminster, which is the political centre of not just London, but also Great Britain and also the Empire. The reason why, of course, railroad termini are more important is because there's a sense that the University of London is the centre of education, not just for London, but also for the kingdom and also finally for the empire. Ultimately, then, the University of London became configured as the imperial university in the imperial capital, with an early global scholarly network in place centering on it, tied by internal and external degrees through examination. So to bring us right up to the present and away from all of this emphasis on sort of physical embeddedness and location, I want to conclude just by asking us to think, as others have, of other kinds of networks within which the scholarly network is embedded. And I end up with the notion that the University of London is embedded within an imperial network, just to raise the question of the political, the economic, and cultural networks within which any consideration of scholarly networks has to take place as well. Thank you.